Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm going to jump right into it, and we'll get to our traffic report a little bit later because I know our next guest is on a bit of a tight schedule, as it were. As we go out to our SDCCU fan hotline, joined by writer Jeff Perlman, who has a number of books. You probably, if you're a sports fan, you've read at least a couple of them. The new one, though, is called Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. And Jeff Perlman joins me now here on 97.3 The Fan. Jeff, good morning.
Hey, I just want to say for the record, I think it's important to get this out quick. My book is not the 73rd political book to be released this month. So I just want to make that clear. It is not a political book.
It's not an election year book. You didn't time this to coincide with an important election in American politics, Jeff. First of all, just the process of writing a book, I am always amazed. It's I've started my book and never gotten past like paragraph 3 before. So just the work that goes into that. I mean, you've been a prolific author now. What is that process like for you?
It's exhausting. It's taxing. It's rewarding. I usually take 2 years to write a book, and I will, the first, year and a half is just reporting. So it's tracking everyone down. It's building a library. It literally is a literal building of a library. Like, I ended up printing out 10,000 pages of Laker-related articles. I probably bought about 40 books off of eBay of related topics. And at the same time, you're tracking down, 300, 400, 500, however many people you can to talk. And then after you have 6 months and I cobble it all together and just kind of do my best. But it's a lot of greatness. I never wear shoes. I drop my kids off at school. I have good stuff, but it's also physically dying. It beats you down a little bit. It definitely does.
So with that process, that means that all of the work, really, the research and everything for this book and probably most of the writing happened before Kobe Bryant's tragic death. How did the helicopter accident earlier this year kind of impact this whole process for you on talking about Kobe and Shaq in particular?
Well, on a personal level, obviously it was devastating. And also living out here, I live out here too in Southern California, and you definitely felt it more than I did where I still living in New York. The book was done. It was edited. It was one of those things where it's like, all right, we're not adding anything else. And then this happens and you sort of wait a little bit and try to figure out how to digest it. And what I ended up doing is just writing a note, an author's note at the beginning, sincerely sort of expressing that the Kobe you're going to read here from 96 to 04, it's not the Kobe who died at 41. And it's a mistake to confuse people as they're growing and developing for who they were at the end. And the guy who you saw at the end, four daughters who, Academy Award winner and youth basketball coach, all that stuff. Like, he wasn't the same guy. And I just wanted people to know that this book was a piece of his life. It was a period of his life. It was a big period of his life. But the stuff you're going to read, some of it not that flattering, isn't who he was as a fully formed adult.
Yeah, and you've gotten some criticism because it's always tough to look like you're taking shots at a guy who can't defend himself. But I don't think you're really taking shots. I mean, even the most diehard basketball Kobe fan would have to acknowledge that there were some tumultuous, tough times for Kobe, and he wasn't that well-liked of a person. What were some of the kind of incidents that you delved into, and what did you learn about those years of Kobe Bryant as you were working on the book?
I just think he's really fascinating, and he's really, he's one of those guys who was never fully formed. And what I mean is, you know, 90% of us or 99% of us, we go through school, we go through life. Sometimes we have a good day. Sometimes we have a bad day. We go to the prom. We get our driver's license. You know, the highs, lows, rejections, blah, blah, blah. You know, he was raised in Italy, the son of a basketball star. He was going to be a basketball star. He moves to suburban Philadelphia, Lower Merion. He's a star. He's one of the few African-American kids ever in his surroundings. He goes straight from high school to the NBA, has a sneaker contract with Adidas for millions of dollars heading into the NBA. He shows up in the NBA insanely, unjustifiably confident and arrogant, and pronounces at his first team meeting, nobody here is going to punk me, when he's 18 years old, surrounded by all these veterans. Like, he was just different. And through the years, if you look at him, he went through phases. Like, he comes into the NBA and he's just imitating Michael Jordan left and right. Not as a player, just cadence, mannerisms, licking the lips, you know, everything was just a weird Jordan tribute. Then he tries becoming tougher and he's trying to become more like Iverson and Marbury, these guys he came into the league with. Then he goes through this kind of Will Smith phase. Then after Eagle Colorado, or as it's going down, he starts getting tattoos and he's cursing a lot and he's going through this kind of fake tough guy phase. And I just think, not until he sort of had his own NBA mortality toward the end of his career, when he wasn't the star anymore and he struggled and he got hurt, I think that's when he kind of found his voice and found who he was. But a lot of the book was kind of a sad effort of Kobe Bryant in the shadow of Shaquille O'Neal, stumbling around, not really knowing who he was.
How difficult was that? We're talking to Jeff Perlman, author of Three Ring Circus, new book on Kobe, Shaq, and Phil. How difficult was that for both of them? Because really, the Lakers are not the Lakers if it's just Shaquille O'Neal, and Kobe Bryant can't do it without Shaquille O'Neal either. O'Neal can't do it without Kobe, but they're both these giant personalities who sometimes clash, sometimes give each other credit. What did you learn from Shaq as you were working on this?
Well, I'd say two things. Number one, I would argue they probably could do it with each other, without each other, because Kobe went on to win two and Shaq went on to win one. So I do think, you know, like, if it had been Allen Iverson instead of Kobe in L.A., I think L.A. is still really good. And if it had been Alonzo Mourning instead of Shaq with Kobe, they're probably really good. They just happen to have two of the four best players in the NBA on the court at the same time. It was really weird. Like, there's one story someone told me that kind of summed it up well. Shaq takes the entire team out for dinner at a fancy seafood restaurant on the road. And Kobe passes. And then he walks into the restaurant a half hour later with a book and sits by himself. And they all see him at a table by himself. When he got married to Vanessa and Dana Point, not only didn't he invite any teammates, none, to his wedding. Most of his teammates didn't know he was getting married. Some of them didn't even know he was dating someone. There's a scene that I found really telling, too. It's 2003. Thanksgiving is coming. It's the last game before Thanksgiving. And Karl Malone is on the Lakers. And at one point, he's doing an interview with a reporter. And he watches Kobe about to leave the locker room. And he says to the reporter, hold on a second. He says, hey, young buck, come over here for a minute. Karl Malone calls Kobe over. And he whispers into his ear. And then Kobe walks off and wishes all his teammates like a good Thanksgiving. Hey, man, have a good Thanksgiving. Have a good Thanksgiving. Like, he didn't have that social skill to naturally think, okay, I'm kind of a star in this team. Thanksgiving is coming. I should wish them all a good Thanksgiving. There was something there that wasn't fully formed. And, you know, Shaq just wanted to be loved, and he wanted you to receive his love warmly. Like, he wanted to buy you a new suit. He wanted to fly your family into the game. He wanted to pay for your parents' funeral. He did that. He wanted to set you up on dates. Like, he wanted to do that stuff, but you had to show some level of appreciation or affection. And Kobe just never felt that and never offered that.
So last thing, Jeff, what do you think it was that changed Kobe from the one that you wrote about, 1996 to 2004, into the Kobe who passed away earlier this year, the inspirational figure, the champion for women's and women's athletes, the family guy, the different Kobe that he became later in life?
Well, I think a lot of it is having kids. It changes you in profound ways, and it suddenly makes you not that important. I do think a big part of it was after he got hurt and toward the end of his career. I mean, the interviews he did, the guy he was the last year of his career was unrecognizable to people who played with him early on, where he was just admitted to getting old and waking up sore and not being the player he used to be. And I just think a lot of athletes need to go through that. They really do. It's like the gateway to life is having a year or two where you're no longer a superstar, and you just accept that, and you learn to deal with your mortality from sports. And I think that was really hugely profoundly important to Kobe for the rest of his life.
Well, Jeff, congratulations on what is sure to be another terrific sports book, Three Ring Circus. You can get it at Amazon. Jeff Perlman, appreciate your time.
All right, thank you so much. Take care.
All right, Jeff Perlman, the author with us on our SDCCU fan hotline. It is such a fascinating, Paul, as a Lakers fan, that dynamic between Shaq and Kobe with Phil Jackson. I honestly never understood how Phil really pulled it off. It seems like there were so many moments where that relationship could have been irreparable, where the two just said, we just can't do this anymore. We need to trade one of them. It almost happened more than once where it was like, we cannot do this. And yet somehow they held it together enough to turn that into a dynasty with the Lakers with those two guys. It's almost unbelievable. Well, I mean, can you imagine?
Is there any other coach that could have handled that besides Phil Jackson?
I don't think so. I really don't. Can you imagine if it was me and Woods and, you know, every day it was that dynamic where we're almost adversaries, even though we're teammates, and you had to, like, try to keep the peace every single day between us? It would be exhausting. It would be absolutely exhausting to live the life that Phil Jackson must have lived during that era. But then again, it was also worth it because what emerged was greatness that you really couldn't duplicate under any other circumstances. So.
It's crazy. I mean, is there any doubt that they would have won 5, 6, 7 titles together if they were able to keep that going?
I mean, yeah, probably. They probably could have kept it going. I mean, Shaq, you know, I think the Lakers did sort of. I think Shaq at some point was, you know, on the downhill portion of his career, and they saw Kobe was still in his prime, and they decided, let's revamp for a couple of years, and then they ended up bringing in Pau Gasol for a kind of second half of that run. I think the Lakers handled it pretty well, actually, in sticking with Kobe rather than Shaq. There were a lot of Lakers fans who said, hey, if one of them has to go, get rid of Kobe. We all love Shaq. Shaq is lovable. We can't lose Shaq. But the long-term play, the smart play, was keeping Kobe around, and that turned out to be the case. Good stuff. Let's go back now, since I got to Jeff quickly, and get our final check of traffic here on 97.3 The Fan. Here's Kelly Danick. In this hour of Ben and Woods, final hour brought to you by Spectrum Business. At Spectrum Business, the price you see is the price you pay. There are no added phone taxes or hidden fees for internet and phone service. And unlike other providers, there's no more guesswork trying to figure out how much you'll actually pay every month. With Spectrum Business, you'll know. I got to most things. I did not mention yesterday was Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals. And it was an interesting story. The Tampa Bay Lightning won the game 5-2, and they got a real lift from the return of their captain. Steven Stamkos made his playoff debut. He had been out of the bubble after getting hurt. He had surgery before COVID even hit and would have been out for the season, obviously, had there not been this giant shutdown and delay. But because it's taken so long and gone all the way into late September, he was able to finally recover, get back, get in shape, and join his team now in time for Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals. And after not having played since, again, February, which in 2020 doesn't just feel like 8 months ago, it feels like a lifetime ago, scores a goal on his very first shot and helps lead the Lightning to a 5-2 win. Talk about, like, an uplifting moment, Paul. I'm trying to imagine, like, if the Padres, you know, all of a sudden, if they get to the World Series and then, you know, Mike Clevenger had been out, but then he's able to come back and start Game 4 and, you know, ends up tossing, you know, 7 innings of shutout ball. I mean, what kind of lift must that give a team to get someone back? Or if, like, Kirby Yates all of a sudden returned to save Game 7 of the NLCS or something. That would be an amazing lift.
I mean, that's what I was thinking. What, Clevenger is out, but there's a chance that maybe he could come back for, like, the World Series or something. He comes back and just shoves. I don't know. I guess that's the only, like, Padres comparison I could come up with there. That's a great story.
The one thing you do have to be careful with Mike Clevenger is, remember, he's not a rental. If he was simply a free agent at the end of the year, and, you know, the Padres just, you know, were borrowing him for a couple of months, you might push him a little bit. Go, hey, you think you can push through? You can push through this stiffness, or we can get you back after 10 days and get you going. remember, the Padres expect Mike Clevinger to be part of their rotation next season and in 2022 as well. So the last thing you really want to do would be to send someone out and potentially, you know, cause a further injury. Because one of the things that, you know, pitching coaches and pitchers will tell you is the easiest way to suffer a serious injury is to try to pitch through a smaller one that causes you to, you know, adjust your mechanics, you know, change your arm a little bit. And then all of a sudden you're looking at Tommy John surgery and you're out for the next 16 months or more. So remember, there is a long-term picture here for the Padres and Mike Clevinger. Usually you think playoffs, hey, it all goes out the window. We trade anything for a World Series title, but that's still kind of short-sighted because you don't guarantee yourself a World Series title if Mike Clevinger pitches. You're not guaranteed not to win one if he doesn't. I mean, you're still going to have to pitch most days without Mike Clevinger, even if he was in the rotation. And you have 2 years now where you'd want to have Mike Clevinger helping you in a 162-game season, so you want him as healthy as possible going into next season. So,
well, but then
there
what's
is
the
a
right answer
consideration
there?
Here.
What's the right answer? I mean, if he, let's just say the MRI results are in the Padres' favor and it's nothing serious, and you know maybe he's out for a week or two and he's feeling good in, call it 2 weeks, and he's ready to go. He throws a bullpen and everything's going well. I mean, are you supposed to – you got to throw him out there, right? Like, and do you take the risk?
I don't know.
I mean, that's what they did yesterday, right?
Take the Washington Nationals a few years ago, for example. Steven Strasburg, you know, obviously he was coming off of the Tommy John surgery, but perfectly healthy at the end of the season. And then he didn't pitch in the division series because he had reached his inning limit for the year. And they ended up losing in five games, a team that a lot of people thought could have been a World Series favorite that year. And for many years, the Nationals were ripped mercilessly, saying, hey, you had your one shot, and you left Steven Strasburg on the bench. Well, guess what? A few years later, Steven Strasburg ends up being your World Series MVP, and you get that ring. They had the long view. It took a while. It took some criticism, but it eventually paid off for them, that conservative approach. Who knows what happens if Steven Strasburg pitches, gets hurt again? Maybe his career is never the same if they pushed him that year. I don't know what would have happened, but
right, or he pitches and they win.
Consideration with Clevinger,
or he pitches and they win, and now they have two rings. I mean, it's just
you
never know.
Sure,
you
never know.
You're right. It's a tough call to make.
The other thing you don't know, and we can talk about this a little bit more tomorrow with Woodsy, and even on Monday and Tuesday, because the Padres don't have to set their playoff roster, I think, until Wednesday morning before game one of the division series, is what are you going to do with that? You kind of have an extra guy now. With everyone healthy, with Pham and Hosmer both back, you don't have a position for everyone. You know, Jake Cronenworth has pretty much earned an everyday spot, likely at second base. So that pushed Jurickson Profar to left field. Now, Tommy Pham was supposed to be your everyday left fielder, but Jurickson Profar has been more productive than Tommy Pham so far this year. Do you leave one of those guys? I mean, you have to leave one of them out of the starting lineup. Do you leave them off the playoff roster entirely, or do you just say, hey, Jurickson, you're just going to have to pinch hit, or Tommy Pham, you're just going to have to be a pinch hitter because Jurickson's our starter and he's just outperformed you this season? Or do you go with the guy that you thought was going to be one of your core players in Tommy Pham, who's yet to kind of get healthy and live up to those expectations?
God, that's a tough call that I'm glad I don't have to make, because, I mean, yeah, what do you do? Like, I mean, Profar's played extremely well. He's totally earned that spot. But then again, Tommy Pham's the guy that you brought in for that spot. And, you know, you went out and acquired Mitch Moreland to have these big postseason at-bats and that experience and hit a big home run or whatever in the postseason. But, I mean, he really has not earned a whole lot of big time at bats right now based on what he's done since he got to San Diego. So I don't know, man. I think that's a really interesting discussion to have.
I mean, Profar, the switch hitter, I mean, do you have him out there in left? Tommy Pham is your designated hitter against lefties, and Mitch Moreland's your designated hitter against righties. I don't know. It's going to be make for some unusual decisions.
And I wonder how that impacts
the Padres to have to make.
I wonder how those players then feel about it. I mean, hopefully you would want them to say, well, you know, whatever's best for the team, put the team ahead of them. But I mean, if you're Tommy Pham, you're like, yo, I'm the star player. Like, I was the guy brought in to play left field. What are you doing? Or if you're Jurickson Profar, you're like, I've done everything I've been asked of, and I've done it pretty well. Like, that should be my spot.
Definitely a conversation we're going to need to have moving forward. Finally, breaking news on 97.3 The Fan is brought to you by Pennzoil. Motor oil is made from natural gas. proof is in the Pennzoil. I got nothing for you, though, on Mike Clevenger. My guess is the Padres will continue to take as much time as they possibly can to evaluate, see how he feels before making any decisions. As you mentioned, we did see Michelle Baez is with the team in San Francisco. That could just be an extra doubleheader body for tomorrow. He could be on the taxi squad. We don't really know. Maybe we'll know tomorrow morning when Woodsy returns. Thanks to Paul Reindel, executive producer. I'm Ben Higgins. Have a great Thursday from San Diego's number one sports station, 97.3 The Fan.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.